realfaith.org.au.
So one of our first neighbours that we met, her name was Pooh, P-double-O. We loved Pooh. She would cook food out the front of her house, and so it was terrific. Actually, when my mother-in-law would come over, the kids used to love it and say, "Omar, Omar, we're having Pooh food for dinner tonight." And Omar would, you know, tut-tut at them, and what kind of food, you know, is Pooh food, you know. But Pooh became a good friend to our family.
Welcome to Real Faith. Conversations about the impact faith has on our lives and the challenges we go through, helping us today and giving us hope for tomorrow. That's Real People, Real Life and Real Faith with Eric Scatterbo.
Ash Barker and his family left everything in Australia to live for several years in a slum in Bangkok, Thailand. While there, an unusually named book garnered worldwide attention and helped to bring work to many of the people living there. This is just one of the many success stories he's been a part of in his and his wife's lifelong work of ministering to people in poor urban neighborhoods. Welcome to the program, Dr. Ash Barker.
Thank you for having me, Eric. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you with us. And so we're going to talk about your time in the slum in Bangkok, Thailand, leaving everything to go there. But actually, the story goes back before that, because for a while you lived in a low socioeconomic area here in Melbourne. Is that right?
Yep. So we lived in Springvale, which is a very multiracial, multicultural community. We'd been working with Youth for Christ and working in prisons and youth detention centers. And we were finding once kids were in the system, it was really difficult. And so how could we prevent young people going to the systems or would go where they were from? And in Melbourne, these kids weren't coming from every neighbourhood. They were only coming from a few neighbourhoods. So we started youth clubs and camping programs and mentoring programs as part of Youth for Christ response to urban young people.
And I should interrupt you there because you keep on saying we. Tell us about how you met your wife.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, Ange and I both stood up at a Tony Campolo meeting as 18-year-olds, ready to go anywhere for the cause of Christ. This idea that Jesus, after what Jesus has done for me, there's nothing I wouldn't do for him. Out of gratitude, we would give our lives, surrender our lives to Christ. Ange and I both made those commitments separately. We met 6 months later.
Oh, is that right? I thought you were like at the same meeting.
We were at the same meeting, but we weren't together.
Is that right?
We only met 6 months later.
Oh, wow.
She thought she was going to Haiti. I thought I was going to China for some reason. We fell madly in love. We got married as 20-year-olds.
But you both had a heart for helping economically needy people. Yeah. What was the common denominator?
Matthew 25:31, the idea of the sheep and the goats, that as we do it to the least of these, we do it to Jesus. Something spiritual happens when we engage those who are suffering and those who are hurting. And I think for both, Angela, that caught our imagination and our hearts. And we started where we were. I was in Dingley running youth groups and drop-in centres and working in schools as volunteers. And Ange was working with homeless people in a Balcom Infusion kind of centre. And I think both of us were kind of saying, is this the real deal? Is this just a phase we're going through? Is this what we committed to? And I think both of us were worried about committing to people who wouldn't go all the way with God, that we really wanted to surrender our whole lives to God. And so we met each other, we fell madly in love, and so we got married as 20-year-olds. So we were quite young when we got married. Yeah. And started with Youth for Christ very quickly. So Ange was still finishing her social work degree, I was finishing my theology degree, but working in juvenile detention centres initially.
And so you mentioned that you were in the area of Springvale.
Yes.
On the east side of Melbourne. What brought about you living there?
Yeah, so Dingley is where I grew up and where Ange and I first moved to when we were married. And we were starting to, it was when a lot of Vietnamese refugees were coming. We had our initial work in Dingley, youth clubs, and then needs really were just over the border. So it was not far away, Springvale, really. In fact, in those days, Dingley was part of the city of Springvale.
Oh, okay.
But it was a more affluent part of the city. And then we moved into the city centre really to follow up with the young people, particularly Pacific Islanders, Vietnamese refugees, Cambodians, and to open our homes and lives together. We started churches. We started a group called Urban Neighbours of Hope. So that's really where the approach came from. Living in right next to the train station in Springvale, those days had a quite serious heroin problem. So it was not uncommon to have young people dying on our front nature strip. I still remember. Ange ringing the phone, ringing the ambulance. Ash, you know, someone's dropped. So I ran down and there was no pulse. There was no breath. I'm about to, do mouth to mouth, and I'm just praying really, Lord, please do something.
Yeah.
And he came back to life actually while I was there. And I don't know who was more stunned, me or him. I didn't quite know what to do. Bible college hadn't really prepared for me. Come back to life on your front nature strip. So I did the best I could. Would you like to come up for a cup of tea upstairs? So we came upstairs, and we heard his story, and he'd just come out of prison. This was a harsh dose of heroin that he wasn't prepared for, and I said, look, there's all kinds of reasons why you're here now, but we prayed and you're here, and God has a plan for your life. And I think those kinds of experiences, while they didn't happen all the time, they really formed us. I think we found two lessons, really. One, that when we love people and are open to God's love and help introduce people to Jesus, that miracles can happen. People's lives can change. Mm-hmm. And we saw that happening. Churches started, etc. But also our lives change. That when people don't change, a second miracle can happen, that we become more compassionate. We find our...
When they don't change?
Yeah, when other people don't change, we change.
And how does that work?
Well, for example... One of the young men we got to know was part of our youth club. His name was Metakore. His name means no parent in Pacific Island language. And, his grandfather was struggling. There was so many kids in the house. He hadn't got to year seven. And, his grandfather said, would you take, Metakore on? You know, I said, well, he's part of my small group. Then would you take him on like your son? So I better talk to Ange about that.
Yeah.
And I talked to Ange, and Ange, of course, this is why we've moved to Springvale. If we can't take up a kid who's named Metakore, no parent, what are we doing? And so he became part of our life, and we got him through the whole of year eight. He was a real character. I'm a very, very funny kid. We found out he actually had an intellectual disability. Later that year, he was about 14, I think it was, when his girlfriend had a baby, and Christine was born. And that just kind of the psychiatric kind of stuff really kicked in at that point. Started seeing faces in trees and becoming really paranoid, thought little baby Christine was trying to kill him, and smashed windows and tried to break down doors to get at her. And we loved him and we cared for him and believed that God would somehow heal and intervene. We went to hundreds of meetings with in and out of jails and hospitals and social workers, but he died, actually. He got the phone call from the police saying, would you come and identify the body? And I still remember the funeral. Cook Island funerals are really kind of powerful. They're big events. And
very emotional.
Very emotional. People yelling and screaming, and you have an open casket. And I still remember kissing his forehead like others, and saying, you didn't change the way we wanted. We prayed, but I'm a different person. You took me to the edge. You took me to the margins. You showed me the way the world really is. Later, I reflected.
Well, I was just going to say, at that point, somebody could say, what am I doing here? I'm not even making a difference.
Yeah.
He's passed away. Throw in the towel.
Yeah.
But you're saying it made you a better person?
It did. I don't know if you remember the movie Titanic, there's Rose on the top deck. And my life, by having great Christian parents, having really good people who loved me around me, it was a top deck kind of experience. Mm. And Metakore was like my Jack in the movie, who showed me the way the world really is. And so actually I became more determined because of the way the world really was, that so much suffering was going on, that I wanted to try and prevent this happening for other people. And a sense of call birthed in both Ange and I out of that tragedy, that his legacy Matus wouldn't die in vain, that we would dedicate our lives to seeing lives change through Jesus, and that we would invest everything we had to do that. And Urban Neighbours of Hope started, really, and it continues on. And at one point it was in, you know, six different cities around the world, and workers were doing this, caring, standing with people, seeing people's skills and assets be developed, and social enterprises and churches and youth groups and football clubs, all kinds of things would come out of standing with people in solidarity and sharing our lives and sharing Jesus. And so that was a really important part of our journey.
Okay, and so that was in the Melbourne
area.
That's
in Melbourne, yeah.
How do we get from there to the slums of Bangkok?
Yeah, we still felt that maybe we did have a chapter in us to go to some of the world's poorest. And so we thought, oh, we've got a sabbatical coming up. Maybe we should spend our time in Vietnam. We work with a lot of Vietnamese people.
Now, when people have some time off, they'll go to Hawaii or something. You decided to go to the slums of...
Yeah, well, initially to Vietnam, actually, because we thought maybe, because we spoke Vietnamese, worked with a lot of Vietnamese young people.
Oh, okay, so you already had that familiarity with the culture.
Yeah, in Vietnam.
Yep.
But actually, we couldn't get a visa long term, and there's and so a friend of mine was at the Australian Embassy in Bangkok, and he said, "Well, come to." He knew us very well. We were youth group together. Mick said to us, "Yeah, come to Bangkok. There's great slums here in Bangkok. You'll love it."
We got some great ones here.
This is 1999, and we'd started Urban Neighbours Over in 93, so it was kind of a good time to take stock of where we were going. And actually, we fell in love with the place. And a year later, I went to visit the families we stayed with. Angie had been working in an AIDS hospice. I'd been teaching football and English and writing a book. And I saw the families again. Blair and her family particularly had been very kind to us. And I just, as I walked into the slum again, I just felt this sense I was home. This is where I was supposed to be. And I didn't quite know what to do with it. I went back to Angie and said, I do wonder, Amy was... about 4 years old at that point.
Your daughter?
Our daughter. And there was that kind of sense that if we went before she started, you know, getting fully into school, we kind of had some windows. And I'm trying to explain this rationally to Ange, but actually it was this intuition, really, that God wanted us to be at home in Klong Toi Slum. I mean, it's a slum of 100,000 people, 2 square kilometres. And Ange didn't blink. In fact, she burst into tears. That, oh, no, now I've done it. But she said, I thought we had to give up this dream. We talked about this as teenagers, and to have the opportunity to do it would be amazing. Now, it took about 18 months to be able to be in discernment and find out what we needed and find visas and partners. We really wanted to work with the Church of Christ in Thailand, which was the indigenous church, and then be invited in. Amazingly, the head of our board at that time, John Gilmore, knew the head of the Church of Christ in Thailand, Dr. Sint, and he said, wow, if you're interested in Klong Toi, we've actually got a community center.
Our guest today is Ash Barker from Melbourne, Australia, sharing his life journey. We're going to take a break, and when we return, we'll find out about his family living in the slums of Bangkok, Thailand, and also about an unusually named book that garnered worldwide attention. All that and more when we return right here on Real Faith.
The Word for Today is Australia's most widely read daily devotional, designed to give you practical teaching to keep you focused on your relationship with Jesus. Read it online or subscribe to the free printed edition at thewordfortoday.com.au. You're listening to Real Faith, conversations with real people about how God works in their lives. If you want to know more about integrating faith into your life, our website is realfaith.org.au. Just go to the website and you'll find helpful articles about the impact faith can have on your life. Once again, that's realfaith.org.au.
Welcome back. I'm Eric Scadabo, and our guest today is Ash Barker, the director of the New Begin School for Urban Leadership, located in Birmingham, England. But we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, because first, before we talk about his move to England, we want to talk about the time he and his family spent in the slums of Bangkok, Thailand.
And so, yeah, we spent 12 years in Klong Toi. It was an incredibly demanding place. Dengue fever 4 times, dysentery, typhoid, typhus, all those kind of things that your body's just not used to living in open sewers and rats and all that kind of stuff. but it had such a profound impact to us. Well, you mentioned the book, the unusual name.
Tell the story behind that one, please.
Yeah. So one of our first neighbors that we met, her name was Pooh, P-double-O. We loved Pooh. She was one of
which was short for?
Shampoo. So Shampoo is a fruit, but everyone called her Pooh, and we thought that was quite funny. She would cook food out the front of her house, and so it was terrific. Actually, when my mother-in-law would come over, the kids used to love it and say, Omar, we're having Pooh food for dinner tonight. And Omar would, you know, tut-tut at them, and what kind of food, you know, is Pooh food, you know. So we loved it. We thought it was quite funny. We didn't speak a lot of Thai when we first went there. We were in school there, learning the language. It was really tough. But Pooh became a good friend to our family. One day the price of rice went through the roof. Basically, the subsidies of the rice was taken off. And so the price of rice went through the roof, but people's wages didn't go up. And Pooh, being a Buddhist person, really hoped that her luck would change. She went to the temple and all those kind of things to try and see whether her luck would change. She kept selling the food at that price and was starting to get into serious debt. When you get into debt in a place like Klong Toi, the debt people are incredibly dangerous. It's basically organized crime groups that do that. So she was quite scared. She came to Ange one day and said, look, is there some way you can get me a job out of the slum maybe? And she had two boys, a husband that wasn't working a lot at that point. And so she really was, you know, working from 5 a.m. until 9 p.m. and still losing money.
Wow.
So Ange said, well, you're such a great cook. Why don't you start a cooking school? It will be great fun. You're such good company with people. People would love it. And people pay a fortune here, foreigners, to learn how to cook Thai food. It's known
around
the world.
Yeah, it's a new thing. What do they call that? Cooking tourism or something?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So Ange, we had some friends come over. Pooh initially said, look, I couldn't do that. I don't have enough English. I don't have, but we helped her learn English. When we had friends come over, she said, well, just try it out, you know. So you take them to the local market. Markets in Bangkok are crazy. You know, there's cockroaches that are fried to eat, and you've got frogs with their stomachs cut open, the heart still beating. And so it's a freaky kind of market.
Yeah,
and then to buy the food for the ingredients and then take them back to her house and teach people how to cook nutritious, quick, easy Thai meals. People loved it. And so when we launched the cooking school, it became the number one thing to do on TripAdvisor within 6 months. Number two was the Grand Palace. But the book you're talking about was a friend of ours here from Melbourne, actually. It was a brilliant photographer. And she said, why don't you do a cookbook? You know, and so Ange worked with Pooh to do the ingredients and tell stories in the community. And then Shelley came over and took these brilliant photographs of the community and the food. Mm-hmm. And then we're talking with a journalist friend, you know, how do we, you know, market this? How do we get it out there? And Ange came up with the idea, why don't we call the book Cooking with Pooh? And to this day, they've not spent a cent in marketing. It sold 40,000 copies. The big breakthrough came when someone put the book in the Frankfurt Book Fair, the biggest book fair in the world.
Wow.
And it won the title of oddest book title of the year. Then comedians all around the world picked it up. And Pooh cooked with Jamie Oliver. You know,
is that right?
Yeah, and it did a show. If you look up Cooking with Pooh and Jamie Oliver, you'll see Jamie Oliver cooking right next to Pooh and learning. And the apron says, I cooked with Pooh, and I liked it. But the great thing about that isn't just this huge amount of income that was being brought in.
Yeah, she was in a desperate situation. So this is an answer to prayer in itself.
It was, and she really saw it as a gift from God. Interesting, when I tried to launch my book, Slum Life Rising, my PhD work on the rise of slums, and you need all the help you can get. So I have my celebrity chef friend, you know, Pooh, come to this, to the Foreign Correspondents Press Club. But the first question went to Pooh, and it was a really good question. It said, well, you're so successful, Pooh, with your book and with your cooking school, but you've got two boys and you continue to live in Klong Toi slum, most notorious slum in Bangkok. Why do you stay if you don't need to? And she said, well, I'm not as wealthy as you might think. What we've been doing is keeping this money separate into a charity, and we help other people start small businesses. Because I used to have to work from 5 a.m. till 9 p.m. And if we didn't, and even then, sometimes we wouldn't make. So I can never have a holiday, never have a day off. Well, now I can have a holiday. Now I can have days off. Mm. And I want other people to have the same blessings that I have had. And so she stays. And we were just there with her in July. And she's a remarkable still this vibrant, wonderful person who's impacted so many people's lives. I think you talk about miracle A's for other people's lives being transformed. The number of people's lives, not every day, the people who come to a cooking school, but also the small businesses, the church she's part of, and the joy that she brings to so many. It's just kind of a privilege. But you could never generate that yourself. You could never come with a marketing plan. Okay, we're going to find someone with a funny name and market a book and sell 40,000 copies. It doesn't work like that. It works from the ground up, that as we seek to join with what God is doing in a community, it's amazing what fruit can come. But it's a special place, and even going back there just last month and seeing the seeing all our folks, hundreds of people that people never forget what even the smallest thing that we've done over the years, people remembered and were grateful, and we felt it was such a big part of our lives and such a big influence on our theology and the way we view God, but also just the friendships that were that were generated in that cauldron of. Have kept us in good stead.
Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time, but you said you've gone back there because that's not where you are. You've gone on to another economically depressed area in the world.
Yeah, so we really felt like our next season in life was how do we invest in urban leaders? Mm-hmm. And we wanted to demonstrate that, and so we had an opportunity to work in inner city Birmingham. It's a tough neighborhood, the big, massive prison there, 1,600 prisoners. There was a documentary made about our neighborhood called Benefit Street, which showed the depravity and the struggle that was happening in that community. And we took over an old, disused vicarage and all the kind of things we did in Bangkok with social enterprise to really demonstrate what we're going on. But then the trick is how do we mobilize and support and grow leaders from within communities like that all around the country?
Obviously, you're having a positive impact on the parts of the world that you've been in the economically poor area in the Melbourne area, then the slum of Bangkok, and now in another economically depressed part of Birmingham, England. But what if somebody said, okay, that's nice, you're helping people get jobs and income, but what about the spiritual impact? What would you say?
Yeah, I think it's impossible to separate the spiritual from the physical. As Christians, we believe the word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood, that God values the physical and is present. And so I don't think it's as simple as saying this is the spiritual bit, this is the physical bit. It's all integrated. So for us, Jesus is about life and having life in abundance and fullness. And so what we want to see happen is people to encounter this Jesus who will give them life. Mm-hmm. And so we give opportunity for that as part of what we're doing. It's a normal part of our life. It doesn't have to be an extra bit. It isn't even a bit that we're going to give you food and come to this community meal, but what we really want you to do is come along to our church. No, feeding people, enabling people to have food and being involved in as friends and part of the community, all that's good. And so sharing Jesus becomes a natural part of our life. And so people become, want that opportunity to go deeper. I think there's different kind of on-ramps for that, but we want to make sure people want to do it as a response to Jesus, not just out of manipulation. Sometimes with vulnerable people, and you see this, I see this all the time in Bangkok actually, a lot, where people, the so-called rice Christians, that will offer you rice if you become a Christian. And
kind of a conditional love.
And poor folk will sometimes, who are desperate enough, will do it for the moment, and they'll go through the through the motions.
But
It's not from the heart. In fact, people become very resentful of Christians, and Christians have a bad name for doing that. So we wanted to make sure that people are interested in following Jesus, knowing more about the life that shines in us,
I'm understanding you correctly, you want to genuinely love people.
Yes.
And then once they feel loved, they'll want to know, well, what are you about? There's something different about you.
That's right.
So that's a more of a genuine response.
Yeah, and yes, that's right. And I think when people respond when we're genuine with people and people are genuine with us, that Jesus is found in the middle of those discussions and relationships. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there is this mystical kind of encounter. I think that's what Jesus was talking about when he says, when you do it to the least of these, you do it to me. That we find Jesus in that. We encounter Jesus through the other person, and the other person encounters Jesus through us. It's mystical, it's spiritual. I don't know how to explain it, but I know it happens. I know people sense Jesus' presence being close. And our message to everybody was that Jesus is not far away from any one of us. and that if we reach out to him, he's reaching out to each of us anyway. And so we just need to respond to him, and it is about surrender. It is about giving up our lives, but we move half a step to Jesus. Jesus moves a full step to us. Mm. And that's a story of grace and the faithfulness of God to each of us if we're open to it.
Amen. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Oh, pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Our guest today has been Dr. Ash Barker. He's the director of the New Begin School of Urban Leadership. For more information, you can go to their website, newbeginhouse.uk. That's newbeginhouse.uk.
You've been listening to Real Faith. And if you have any questions or comments, you can send us a message through our website, realfaith.org.au. That's realfaith.org.au. Thanks for listening, and we invite you to join us again next time for more conversations about God working in the lives of people who put their faith and trust in Him. That's real people, real life, and real faith. This program is a production of Vision Christian Media. To find out more about us, see vision.org.au.